I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Valeria Lucelli is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant and has won 2 Los Angeles Times Book Prizes, an American Book Award, the Folio Prize, and the 2021 International Dublin Literary Award. Her new novel, Beginning, Middle, End, combines a traditional storytelling structure with experimental aspects. Listen to the audiobook and you'll hear soundscape recordings under the narration. Read the physical copy and you'll visualize sections and headings that resemble a mosaic. I recently spoke with Valeria Lucelli about Beginning, Middle, End, about the soundscapes, the mythology that went into the book's creation, and how the novel became a family project that spanned generations. Here's our conversation. So Beginning, Middle, End is a novel with a unique structure. How do you describe it to people? How do you set it up for the reader?
Well, the structure of Beginning, Middle, End, on one hand, is very traditional in the sense that there is a part one called the first part, then there's a second part called the other part, and a third part called the last part. However, that very kind of traditional structure, which is almost tongue-in-cheek in this novel, is really traversed by an architecture that plays with time and moves backward and forward and questions the very way that we think about time in novel writing and in storytelling more generally. And in order to be able to do that, what I've had to do in this book is to really think of it as a kind of mosaic composed of many, many little small stones. So what you'll find when you open Beginning, Middle, End is very short fragments, sometimes with an entire little scene, but sometimes it's more a meditation on something like memory and imagination or the way time moves or nostalgia. And sometimes you will have sort of more plot-driven tiny fragments, but really it's all small fragments, like little mosaic pieces that compose one larger mosaic. And that's very much the way I write, in very small fragments day by day. And I never know where I'm going to go with them or what the story I'm going to tell is even about until very late into the process. So I just accumulate notes for sometimes 3-4 years. And when I have all my little pieces, all those mosaic little stones, then I start playing with plot. Then I start asking bigger questions about themes and repetitions and echoes and internal architecture. The structure that you'll find in the book very much responds to the structure of my own work process.
Well, and you mentioned the 3 sections, the first part, the other part, and the last part. And the first two are these little notes written by the main character, mother, in the book. The third one is written by the daughter. And these little mosaic segments, they all have a headline to it, Volcanic Mountains or Marvels of Fire. And these were pulled from Pliny the Elder's Natural History. And it took me a while. It took me until like page 72 to figure out what was happening here. So can you talk to me about why these headings were there for the mother's notes?
Of course. And I'm very impressed that you figured it out as soon as page 70. You must be one of those readers that needs to know.
I am.
I understand you because my mind works in that way too. And it's not in my favor always because, you know, if I have a puzzle in front of me, I have to fix it. I have to figure it out. And I think there's 2 types of readers or 2 types of people, you know, ones that are willing to just say, okay, I'll get that later. I'll understand that later. I'll come to that. And there's other minds that are like, no, until I don't know this, I cannot let it go, right? And I think both ways of reading, both ways of writing, both ways of being are just who we are, what we have. And it doesn't quite matter if you don't, in reading this novel, it doesn't really matter if you don't understand where those subheadings come from or why they are there until the end. But if you figure it out earlier, maybe you get an extra something. You know, you might understand also where they come from, but not exactly why they're there. And you really don't actually understand why they're there until the very end of the novel. But, you know, for me, in terms of my deeper reasons to use those subheadings as an organizing principle, has to do with the role that Pliny the Elder played in my writing this novel. He was a kind of ghost that accompanied me throughout these years, a kind of Virgil of getting through this passage of time in which I was deep into the weeds of this novel. And that came to be because I was working on something else at that time. I've been working on something else called Echoes from the Borderlands, which is a sonic essay, a sound piece, a very long sound work of 24 hours that documents the sounds of the US-Mexico borderlands. And when I started working on that project, I was very focused on oral histories and human sounds and human stories. But the deeper we delved into the borderlands, the more we came into contact with all the non-human sounds, sounds of dust storms in the Sonoran Desert, and the sounds of a saguaro thorn if you pricked it, and the sound of a brutal rainstorm in Texas. And I just had to reconfigure my understanding of recording and listening, especially recording and listening and paying attention to the natural world. And so I decided to re-educate myself. Like, where do I start? How do I start understanding observation of the natural world? And I read some more contemporary books, and some were fine, some were less interesting, some were too anthropocentric, I felt. And then I decided to just go back a little further, and I tried reading more ancient texts that offered an observation of nature. And I arrived at Pliny the Elder, and I thought, oh my God, this is it. Really, this is where it not exactly where it starts, because the ancient Greeks and especially the pre-Socratic philosophers also had incredible observations that were non-mythological, but, you know, proto-scientific. But it really is Pliny, the first to organize and try to organize all the observations made until his time of the natural world with big questions like, you know, where do winds come from? How are winds formed? And what is a sea tide? And why is the sea salt? And why does the moon spin around the world? And what is the sun? And why do plants grow? And why do animals die at a certain way? And he really just asked all the important questions about our world and what we see from our world outward toward the skies. And so that's the book I had with me for years. I just consulted it. It's not a book really meant to be read from beginning to 36 volumes, and it's impossible to read all. Some parts are really boring also. But the second book of Pliny the Elder's Natural History is one of the most beautiful books I have ever encountered. I recommend everyone to read it. And it's a book that you can just open on any page and you'll find some piece of wisdom about the moon or the sea or rocks or mountains.
Let's talk about your characters for a moment, because we meet the mother, daughter, and grandmother, all who remain nameless, I should note, until page like 268. But we meet them during a transition phase. The grandmother, who is in Mexico, is battling memory loss. The mother and daughter are in Sicily, and the mother has gone through a divorce, and the daughter is approaching her teenage years. As the title reflects, in her notes, the mother often reflects on what makes a beginning, a middle, and an end. Why start the story here?
Yes, the story starts very much as a reflection on a very big question. A very big question, in fact, posed to me by my own daughter years ago during a period of night anxiety and childhood insomnia that she was going through, in which I would read her creation myths and ancient Greek mythology, thinking that that might put her mind in a bigger place so that her anxieties would dissipate a little bit. I don't know if Greek mythology is what one should read if one has insomnia. But anyway, that's what one does, what one can, and that's what I was trying out. And there was one evening where she asked me, Mama, why in all these creation myths, there's always something torn asunder in the beginning? Like, the beginning is always something tearing asunder. And also, what does tearing asunder even mean? And so I was able to explain the second part of the question, like, well, tearing asunder means, you know, something being divided, torn apart, broken. But I wasn't able to answer the big question, why in the beginning is there something broken? And that became the kind of guiding light of this entire book at different scales, at a very large cosmogonic scale. If we think about cosmic beginnings and the beginning of time and the world and the universe, but also at the very small scale of individuals' lives. How is it and why is it that beginnings arise from something breaking, something being lost, something falling apart? And so that's very much where they begin, mother and daughter. The mother has just separated, divorced from the girl's stepfather. So the girl has lost a stepfather and a stepbrother, which probably means losing a brother forever, because there's no paper, no bond, no legal framework for that kind of siblinghood to necessarily continue. So she's lost half her world, her family space, the girl, and the mother is dealing with the loss of a family and at the same time, you know, coming into a middle age as a writer and not knowing exactly what her relationship is to writing and how she can reimagine it. It's become a relationship that she feels is a little self-destructive and not quite luminous, and she's trying to figure that out. And she's also dealing with her own mother's loss of memory, like an incipient case of her early Alzheimer's. And so there's a lot of loss there, and she's trying to think about what beginnings are in the face of what feels like such great losses.
So as you mentioned, the structure mirrors another thread in the novel. The sections are compiled together like a mosaic, a tesserae, and the novel follows the mythology of Proteus, and it features a mosaic of Proteus that has been passed from great-grandmother to grandmother and now to mother-daughter. Why was his myth important to the novel?
So Proteus is an incredible god in the Greek pantheon who is mostly ignored. He's not a very popular divinity. In fact, I just watched the Odyssey yesterday, Nolan's rendering of the Odyssey, and Proteus definitely does not appear there, although he does make an important apparition in Homer's Odyssey. And Proteus is a sea god. He's a kind of sea shepherd, and he is an oracular god, but he is an oracular god in a much bigger sense than most oracles. So usually we think of oracles as future looking entities that reveal our destiny. Proteus can do that, but he also is capable of revealing your present in total clarity and also your past. He's a kind of god of time, although it's not really said that he is a god of time, but he really is. I mean, he can see past, present, and future in complete clarity. But he hates telling mortals anything, anything that they want to know. So if someone captures him, he tries to escape by metamorphosizing into quite ungraspable things at times, like fire and rainstorms and then a rock and then a lion. And so that's his story. The story that comes into the novel is, as you were well saying, that of a mosaic with a representation of the god Proteus. And the narrator's grandmother was a Sicilian woman who worked the fields. And like many people who worked the fields in the early 20th century, she was hired as a day laborer. She had to dress up as a man in order to be hired because she knew she wouldn't get hired as a woman, but she dressed up as a man. And so she gets hired as a day laborer in an excavation site where an archaeologist is looking for an old Roman villa full of mosaics. This Roman villa, by the way, it exists. It's called the Villa Romana del Casale. It's one of the most mind-blowingly beautiful places one will ever see because it was covered by a landslide after an earthquake for 900 years and only dug up at the beginning of the 20th century. So all the mosaics have their full colors. You see these yellows and turquoise stones and lapis lazuli, and there's maps of the world and representations of Polyphemus and of Shiva, the Hindu deity. Anyway, it's a really, really, really wonderful place. There is no representation of Proteus in that place. I made it up. And I just as an aside, have to tell you this story because I still can't make sense of it. But I've gone to Casale many times. I went several times for research, to record things there, sounds, to take pictures, etc. But after having published the book in Italian, Beginning, Middle, End came out in Italian a few months ago. After having published it in Italian, my Italian editors wanted me to go back to Casale so we could record some videos for the publishing house in the ruins. And so they sent the novel to the people who run and who take care of the archaeological site. And they read the novel and then they gave us permission to go film. And the day we arrived, the head of culture came out to say hello to us. And he came to speak with me and he asked me, almost as Italians say, sotto voce, like very, like kind of just whispering almost into my ear. He said, Valeria, I just wanted to ask you if you indeed possess a mosaic that belongs to us. And the question came because in the novel, this grandmother, the Sicilian grandmother, works at this archaeological site and decides to steal because she's so badly paid, so badly treated. And she finds this mosaic piece and she's like, oh, this is beautiful. And she decides to take it. And as you well said, this mosaic is passed down in the family until it, you know, it's traveling with mother and daughter during the summer in which the novel takes place. But yeah, and I should have told him the truth, the head of culture. I should have said, absolutely, I do not have that mosaic. Unfortunately, unfortunately, it's fiction. But I decided not to tell him, and I just smiled and I said, thank you for reading the novel.
I underlined many things in the book, but this one sentence I actually read out loud to a few people since I've finished the novel, and I'm wondering maybe you can comment on it on the other side. What I find difficult to understand when traveling almost anywhere by land is why everyone insists on saying there is no space for anyone else, for people who arrive looking for a life, for a land, for a way to start over. If there are so many empty houses everywhere, so much land, closed down stores and bakeries and printing presses and gas stations, so many plots to be made into stories.
I would just say, right? I mean, almost anywhere in the world where you, I mean, certainly in the U.S., I've traveled vastly in the U.S. I know this country very well. I've been traveling by road for many years, you know, long, long, long road trips. I've traveled the borderlands extensively. I've flown everywhere to give talks here and there. Like, it's, I don't think I know any other country as well as I know the U.S. And there are so many expanses of empty land, but also of abandoned towns and abandoned spaces. And the same goes for small towns in southern France, and the same happens in Italy, and the same, there's so many abandoned lives. And one wonders, right, like when there are so many people fleeing their countries because of the historical actions of countries like the US, of countries like France, like Italy, who have had a very dominating colonial relationship with, be it Latin American countries or African countries, why is it that we cannot come up with an imaginative solution to migration where people are given asylum, allowed to inhabit spaces and revitalizing them, reinventing a town, opening up the bakeries that have been shut down, and using the churches that have been abandoned? What is it? What is our deep fear of others that does not allow us to think of just a more integrated society in which we all kind of respect our differences, our different religions, our different beliefs, belief systems, but where we can coexist? Like, what is it about, why are we so protective, so territorial, and so afraid?
I listened to the audiobook and read the physical book simultaneously, and I noted two unique aspects of the audiobook. First, the inclusion of natural sound recordings made on site in Sicily. Are these from your project?
Yes, and I hope you were able to visit the BME Sound website that we put together. It's just bmesound.com, because it is a little archive of the different stages of recording sound for this novel. So I've been working with sound for many years now. As I was telling you, recording this large project called Echoes from the Borderlands. And then throughout the time, writing Beginning, Middle, End, two collaborators, my partner, who is a sound engineer and a very good friend and collaborator with whom I've also been working with on Echoes from the Borderlands, the three of us went to Sicily several times to different places to record sounds for this novel. And the way we decided to do it was to not really think of sound as any kind of illustration of action or plot, but rather as a kind of Greek chorus made from the elements, where the non-human voices would be speaking. And more concisely, we really wanted to think of the elements as the four Empedoclean elements: fire, water, earth, and air. Among other things, because that idea of the four elements was born in Sicily. Empedocles wrote a beautiful poem titled On Nature, where he described the beginning of the universe as these four elements coming together through a force that he called love, call it now the force of attraction, or, and would come apart through a force that he called discord or strife. Anyway, he is the author of this idea of the four elements and the origin of everything being the combination, separation of these elements. So we decided to seek out forms in which these four elements are expressed in nature. So we recorded a lot of winds. There are so many winds in the island. They're constantly changing. The ones from the east are called the Levante. The ones from the southwest are called the Scirocco. The Ponente comes from the west. And islanders are very conscious of the names of winds. I wonder how my life and our lives, for I live in an island. I live in New York, in Manhattan, and we have no idea what the wind is blowing today is called. You know, we might just know everything a little deeper had we that level of attention. But anyway, we went out to record winds. We recorded marine tides with hydrophones. We recorded rumbles of different fields and mountains with something called a geophone that you bury in the earth. And I think the most spectacular experience was for us to record volcanoes in the area. It's a very densely volcanic geography, the one in Sicily, because Sicily is a place under which the African tectonic plate clashes and collides with the European tectonic plate. So there is an archipelago of volcanoes there that all have different kinds of activity. Sometimes they erupt dramatically. There's a volcano that we recorded called Vulcano, where the name volcano comes from. This is like the proto-volcano. And it doesn't really erupt. It just hisses and whistles. It's a very old volcano, so it's kind of mild. It's like an old, feels like an old man in a rocking chair, just, you know, kind of whistling and sounds beautiful. And the amazing volcano Stromboli, which exhales every 20 to 30 minutes. And it just lets out this enormous like sigh. It's as if like it was one of the places where the earth could just sigh. And it's a beautiful sound. So we recorded volcanoes and their eruptions as, you know, the representatives of fire on Earth. We didn't record fire because we didn't know how to do that. So the sonic novel, if you decide to listen to the novel while you read it or after you read it or maybe instead of reading it, is one where you can listen to the narrative together with all the soundscapes of the island. And those soundscapes are made from these elements.
You know, the second part of the audiobook that I found interesting was the narration. Who narrated this audiobook?
I narrated the voice of the female adult narrator, and my daughter narrated the voice of the narrator's daughter. So it was a family business. And my partner is a sound engineer, so he recorded both of us. So it was a It was a team effort. You know, I like to collaborate with my family in many. Well, actually, my mother's voice also appears in some of the epigraphs, speaking in Spanish and just saying like one line here and there. So yeah, it's all of us there. It was a very beautiful period of working and thinking together.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Beginning, Middle, End?
You know, the comment that makes me the happiest from any reader, you know, it comes once in a while that someone approaches me and says that reading that book, a book I wrote, made them want to write or helped them get unstuck from writing. You know, not everybody needs to want to write, but having that desire to put one's world into words and that coming out of something you read is, I think, one of the most magical things.
Well, the book is Beginning, Middle, End. Valeria Lucelli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth.
And now book reviewer Suzanne Perez says another author is proving himself to be a novelist worth following.
Daniel Mason's new novel, Country People, opens with an unnamed father, mother, and two children making their way across the country, from their home in California to somewhere strange and mysterious. The destination is New England. And the father is the well-educated but socially hapless Miles Shalevsky, who is 12 years into his PhD on Russian folktales and beginning to think he's a disappointment to his family. His wife, Kate, has landed a visiting professorship at a prestigious college in rural Vermont. So the family has packed up everything and relocated. As Miles tells his children during evening story time, Russian folktale style, in a certain kingdom, in a certain land. It is a land of country people, in fact, and what unfolds is a whimsical, joyful, enchanting series of events that, when combined with Mason's stellar prose, elevates this novel to first-class summer reading. Mason's previous novel, North Woods, was a genre-defying literary epic that spanned four centuries through interconnected vignettes. Country People has a similar episodic feel, but this time we experience just a year with the Shalevsky-Petrosian family, as all four members, along with their truffle-hunting dog, Giuseppe, navigate the delights and disappointments of their new home. We follow Miles as he meets a series of eccentric locals who are every bit as colorful as the characters in his Russian folktales. From third-grade teacher Kaylee Swan to lifestyle blogger Candace Farm Candy Flaherty to Norwegian cross-country ski god Bjorn Nordqvist. The family frequents honor system produce stands and embraces the annual Greensbury Elementary clothing sale, where the kids get hand-me-down parkas and patched-up ski pants bearing handwritten name tags from previous generations. Everyone made a big deal about it, which the transplants found charming, a remnant of communal small-town life, Mason writes. Until Miranda explained the ruthlessness, the deals and elbows. You could sometimes trace a good ski bib back through four or five children, and so it could be said one acquired not only clothing, but an entire history. Mason delivers an absurd but tender portrait of rural New England, with a plot that explores larger themes like marriage, parenthood, curiosity, and storytelling, a belief in nature, and the nature of belief. Country People is not a rehash of North Woods, but it exists in a similar magical universe. And Mason has proven himself again as a novelist worth following. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
The fatal shooting of a teenager at a protest in Seattle has gone unsolved for 6 years.
This is open in your face. How are there no answers?
Our investigation has uncovered new evidence and witnesses who say they've never talked to police.
Did police ever call you?
Not once.
Listen to We Keep Us Safe, a new true crime series on the Embedded podcast from NPR.